8. 185 stone steps of varying heights, Mr. Bowditch said, and I counted them as I went down. I moved very slowly with my back planted against the curving stone wall facing the drop. The stones were rough and damp. I kept the flashlight trained on my feet. Varying heights. I didn't want to stumble. A stumble might be the end of me. On number 90, not quite halfway, I heard rustling beneath me. I debated shining my light toward the sound and almost decided not to. If I startled a colony of giant bats and they flew up all around me, I probably would fall. That was good logic, but fear was stronger. I leaned out a bit from the wall, shone my light along the descending curve of the steps, and saw something black crouching 2 dozen steps below. When my light hit it, I had just enough time to see it was one of the jumbo roaches before it fled, scuttering into the black. I took a few deep breaths, told myself I was all right, didn't believe it, and went on. It took 9 or 10 minutes to reach the bottom because I was moving very slowly. It seemed even longer. Every now and then I looked up, and it wasn't particularly comforting to see the circle illuminated by the battery lights growing smaller and smaller. I was deep in the earth and going deeper. I reached the bottom at the 185th step. The floor was packed earth, just as Mr. Bowditch had said, and there were a few blocks that had fallen from the wall, probably from the very top, where the frost and thaw would have first loosened them and then squeezed them out. Mr. Bowditch had grabbed a crack in one of the spaces from which a block had fallen, and it had saved his life. The pile of fallen blocks was streaked with black stuff that I guessed was roach shit. The corridor was there. I stepped over the blocks and into it. Mr. Bowditch had been right. It was so tall, I didn't even think about ducking my head. Now I could hear more rustling up ahead, and guessed they were the roosting bats Mr. Bowditch had warned me about. I don't like the idea of bats. They carry germs, sometimes rabies, but they don't give me the horrors as they did Mr. Bowditch. Going toward the sound of them, I was more curious than anything. Those short curving steps, of varying heights, ringing the drop had given me the phantods, but now I was on solid ground, and that was a big improvement. Of course, there were thousands of tons of rock and soil above me, but this corridor had been down here for a long time, and I didn't think it would pick this moment to collapse and bury me. Nor did I have to fear being buried alive. If the roof fell in, so to speak, I would be killed instantly. Cheerful, I thought. Cheerful I was not, but my fear was being replaced, overshadowed, at least, by excitement. If Mr. Bowditch had been telling the truth, another world was waiting not far up ahead. Having come this far, I wanted to see it. Gold was the very least of it. The dirt floor changed to stone. To cobblestones, in fact, like in old movies on TCM about London in the 19th century. Now the rustling was right over my head, and I snapped off the light. Pitch darkness made me fearful all over again, but I did not want to find myself in a cloud of bats. For all I knew, they might be vampire bats. Unlikely in Illinois. Except I wasn't really in Illinois anymore, was I? I went on a mile at least, Mr. Bowditch had said. So I counted steps until I lost count. At least there was no fear of my flashlight failing if I needed it again. The batteries in the long barrel were fresh. I kept waiting to see daylight, always listening to the soft fluttering overhead. Were the bats really as big as turkey buzzards? I didn't want to know. At last, I saw light, a bright spark, just as Mr. Bowditch had said. I walked on, and the spark turned into a circlet, bright enough to leave an afterimage on my eyes every time I blinked them shut. I had forgotten all about the lightheadedness Mr. Bowditch had spoken of, but when it hit me, I knew exactly what he'd been talking about. Once when I was 10 or so, Bertie Bird and I had hyperventilated our stupid selves and then hugged each other good and tight to see if we would pass out, as some friend of Bertie's had claimed. Neither of us did, but I went all swimmy and fell on my ass in what felt like slow motion. This was like that. I kept walking, but I felt like a helium balloon bobbing along above my own body. And if the string snapped, I would just float away. Then it passed, as Mr. Bowditch had said it did for him. He said there was a border, and that had been it. I had left Century's Rest behind, and Illinois, and America. I was in the other. I reached the opening and saw the ceiling overhead was now earth, with fine tendrils of root dangling down. I ducked under some overhanging vines and stepped out onto a sloping hillside. The sky was gray, but the field was bright red. Poppies spread in a gorgeous blanket, stretching left and right as far as I could see. A path led through the flowers toward a road. On the far side of the road, more poppies ran maybe a mile to thick woods, making me think of the forests that had once grown in my suburban town. The path was faint, but the road wasn't. It was dirt, but wide, not a track, but a thoroughfare. Where the path joined the road, there was a tidy little cottage, with smoke rising from the stone chimney. There were clotheslines with things strung on them that weren't clothes. I couldn't make out what they were. I looked to the far horizon and saw the skyline of a great city. Daylight reflected hazily from its highest towers, as if they were made of glass. Green glass. I had read The Wizard of Oz and seen the movie, and I knew an emerald city when I saw one. 9. The path to the road and the cottage was about half a mile long. I stopped twice, once to look back at the hole in the hillside. It looked like the mouth of a small cave, with those vines dangling over the entrance, and once to look at my cell phone. I was expecting a no-service message, but I didn't even get that. My iPhone wouldn't come on at all. It was just a rectangle of black glass that, over here, would be useful as a paperweight, but not for anything else. I don't remember feeling dazed or amazed, not even by the sight of those glassy spires. I didn't doubt the evidence of my senses. I could see the gray sky above, a low ceiling that suggested rain not far off. I could hear the whicker of growing things against my pants as I walked the narrow path. As I descended the hill, most of the buildings of the city sank from sight. I could only see the highest three spires. I tried to guess how far away it was and couldn't. 30 miles? 40? Best of all was the smell of poppies, like cocoa and vanilla and cherries. Except for putting my face into my mom's hair to inhale her scent when I was small, it was the most delicious aroma that had ever graced my olfactories, hands down. I hoped the rain would hold off, but not because I didn't want to get wet. I knew rain would increase that smell, and the beauty of it might kill me. I'm exaggerating, but not as much as you might think. I saw no rabbits, great or small, but I could hear them, hopping around in the grass and flowers, and once, for a few seconds, I saw tall ears. There was also the chirring sound of crickets, and I wondered if they were big like the roaches and bats. As I neared the back of the cottage, wooden sides, thatched roof, I stopped, bemused by what I could now make out. Hanging from the crisscrossing lines behind the cottage and on either side of it were shoes. Wooden ones, canvas ones, sandals, slippers, One line bowed under the weight of a suede boot with silver buckles. Was it a 7-league boot, like in the old fairy tales? It certainly looked like one to me. I came closer and reached out to touch it. It was as soft as butter and as smooth as satin. Built for the road, I thought. Built for Puss in Boots. Where's the other? As if summoned by the thought, the cottage's back door opened and a woman came out with the other boot in her hand, the buckles gleaming in the mellow light of that white sky day. I knew she was a woman because she was wearing a pink dress and red shoes, also because generous breasts plumped out the bodice of her dress. But her skin was slate gray, and her face was cruelly deformed. It was as if her features had been drawn in charcoal and some bad-tempered deity had rubbed its hand across them, smearing and blurring them almost out of existence. Her eyes were slits, as were her nostrils. Her mouth was a lipless crescent. She spoke to me, but I couldn't tell what she was saying. I think her vocal cords were as blurred out as her face. But the lipless crescent was unmistakably a smile. And there was a feeling, a vibe, if you like, that said I had absolutely nothing to fear from her.
Is he?
She touched the boot hanging on the line. Yes, very nice, I said. Do you understand me? She nodded and then made a gesture I knew well, a thumb and forefinger circle, which means okie-dokie pretty much the world over. Except, I guess, in certain rare cases where imbeciles flash it to mean white's rule. She did some more
is
and
has,
then pointed at my tennis shoes. What? She snatched the boot from the line, where it had been held by two wooden clothespins, the old-fashioned kind that don't have springs. Holding the boots in one hand, she pointed at my tennies with the other, then back to the boots. Asking if I wanted to trade, maybe? I'm tempted, but they don't look my size. She shrugged and hung both boots up. Other shoes and a single green satin slipper with a curled toe like a caliph would wear bobbed and turned in a hesitant breeze. Looking at that mostly erased face made me feel a little woozy. I kept trying to see her features as they had been. I almost could. She walked closer to me and sniffed at my shirt with her slit of a nose. Then she raised her hands to her shoulders and pawed at the air. I don't get it. She bounced on her feet and made a sound that, when added to the way she had sniffed me, clarified things. Do you mean radar? She nodded vigorously enough to make her thinning brown hair fly. She made a
woof, woof, woof
sound, which I guess was the closest she could come to woof, woof, woof. She's at my house. She nodded and put one hand on her chest above her heart. If you mean you love her, I do too, I said. When was the last time you saw her? The shoe woman looked at the sky, seemed to calculate, then shrugged.
Done.
If you mean long, it must have been because she's old now. Doesn't bounce too much these days. But Mr. Bowditch, did you know him? If you know Raids, you must have known Mr. Bowditch. She nodded with the same vigor, and the remains of her mouth turned up in another smile. She only had a few teeth, but the ones I could see were a startling white against her gray skin.
Adrian
Bowditch. She nodded hard enough to sprain her neck. But you don't know how long ago he was here? She looked at the sky, then shook her head. Was Radar young then?
Puppy.
Puppy. More nodding. She took my arm and pulled me around the corner. I had to duck under another line of dangling shoes to keep from being garroted. Over here was a patch of earth that had been turned and raked, as if she was getting ready to plant something. There was also a ramshackle little cart, leaning on a couple of long wooden handles. There were two burlap sacks inside, with green things sticking out of the tops. She knelt down and motioned for me to do the same. We faced each other that way. Her finger moved very slowly and hesitantly as she wrote in the dirt. She paused once or twice, remembering what came next, I think, then went on. SHGUDLIF. And then, after a longer pause, ? I puzzled over it and shook my head. The woman got on all fours and made her version of barking again. Then I got it.
Yes, I said. She's had a very good life. But now she's old, like I said, and she's not doing so well. It caught up with me then. Not just Radar and not just Mr. Bowditch, but everything. The gift that was a burden I was supposed to carry, the decomposing cockroaches, and finding the house at number 1 Sycamore torn apart, probably by the man who had murdered Mr. Heinrich, by the pure craziness of being here, kneeling in the dirt with a mostly unfaced woman who collected shoes and hung them on crisscrossing clotheslines. But above all, it was Raids, thinking of how she sometimes struggled to get up in the morning or after a nap, of how she sometimes didn't eat all her food and then gave me a look that said, "I know I should want it, but I don't." I began to cry. The shoe woman put her arm around my shoulders and hugged me to her.
"Oh, hey,"
she said. Then, with an effort, she got it completely in the clear.
"Okay."
I hugged her back. She had a smell, faint but nice. It was, I realized, the smell of the poppies. I cried it out in big wet sobs, and she held me, patting my back. When I pulled away, she wasn't crying, maybe she couldn't, but the crescent of her mouth was turned down instead of up. I wiped my face with my sleeve and asked if Mr. Bowditch had taught her to write or if she already knew how. She put her gray thumb near her first two fingers, which were kind of stuck together. "He taught you a little?" She nodded, then wrote in the dirt again. FRENS. "He was my friend, too. He passed away." She cocked her head to one side, stringy clumps of hair falling to the shoulder of her dress. "Died." She covered her slit eyes, as pure an expression of grief as I've ever seen. Then she gave me another hug. She let go, pointed to the shoes on the nearest line, and shook her head. "No," I agreed. "He won't need shoes. Not anymore." She made a gesture toward her mouth and chewed, which was sort of awful. Then she pointed at the cottage. "If you're asking if I want to eat, thanks, but I can't. I need to get back. Maybe another time? Soon. I'll bring Radar, if I can." Before he died, Mr. Bowditch said there was a way to make her young again. I know that sounds nuts, but he said it worked for him. It's a big sundial. There. I pointed in the direction of the city. Her slit eyes actually widened a little, and her mouth opened in what was almost an O. She put her hands to her gray cheeks, looking like that famous picture of the woman screaming. She bent to the dirt again and swept away what she had written. This time, she wrote faster, and it might have been a word she'd used often because the spelling was right. DANGER. "I know. I'll be careful." She put her melted fingers to her half-erased mouth in a shh gesture. "Yes, I have to be quiet there. He told me that too. Ma'am, what is your name? Can you tell me your name?" She shook her head impatiently and pointed to her mouth. "Hard for you to speak clearly?" She nodded and wrote in the dirt. DEERIE. She looked at it, shook her head, brushed it away, tried again. D
O-R-A. I asked if Deary was a nickname. At least, I tried, but nickname wouldn't come out of my mouth. It wasn't as if I'd forgotten it, I just couldn't seem to say it. I gave up and asked, "Was Deary Mr. Bowditch's friendly name for you, Dora?" She nodded and stood up, dusting her hands. I got up too. "It was very nice to meet you, Dora." I didn't know her well enough to call her Deary, but I understood why Mr. Bowditch had. Her heart was kind. She nodded, patted my chest, then patted her own, I think to show that we were simpatico. Friends. The crescent of her mouth once more turned up, and she bounced on her red shoes, as I suppose radar might have bounced before her joints got so painful. "Yes, I'll bring her, if I can, if she's able. And I'll take her to the sundial, if I can." Although I had no idea how. She pointed at me, then gently patted her hands on the air, palms down. I'm not sure, but I think it meant, "Be careful." "I will. Thank you for your kindness, Dora." I turned toward the path, but she caught my shirt and tugged me toward the back door of her little domicile. "I really can't..." She nodded to say she understood I couldn't stay for a meal, but kept tugging. At the back door, she pointed up. Something had been carved into the lintel, higher than Dora could reach. It was his initials. A.B. His original initials. I had an idea then, one that sprang from my inability to say the word nickname. I pointed to the initials and said, "That's awesome sauce," was in my mind, the stupidest slang term I could think of, but a good test case. I couldn't get it out of my mouth. It just wouldn't come. Dora was looking at me. "Amazing," I said. "That's amazing." 10. I climbed the hill, ducked through the dangling vines, and started back along the passageway. The sense of faintness, otherworldliness, came and went. The bats were rustling overhead, but I was too preoccupied with what had just happened to pay the sound much mind, and I stupidly turned on the flashlight to see how much farther I had to go. They didn't all fly, but a couple did, and I saw them in the beam of the light. They were big, all right, huge. I walked on, in darkness, one hand outstretched to fend them off if they flapped my way, but they didn't. If there were big roaches, I didn't hear them. I hadn't been able to say nickname. I hadn't been able to say awesome sauce. Would I be able to say Weisenheimer or knuckle sandwich or yo, you trippin', bruh? I didn't think so. I wasn't positive I knew what that inability meant, but I was pretty sure. I'd thought Dora understood me because she understood English, but what if she had understood me because I had been speaking her language? One where words like nickname and awesome sauce didn't exist? When the cobblestone stopped and the dirt began, I felt it was safe to turn the light back on, although I kept it trained at the floor. It was a quarter of a mile between where the cobbles ended and the steps began, Mr. Bowditch had said, even claimed to have measured it out. This time I didn't lose count of my paces, and I had just reached 550 when I saw the steps. Far above, at the top of the well, I could see light from the battery-powered units he'd installed. I climbed with more confidence than I'd felt when going down, but still kept my right shoulder firmly planted against the wall. I emerged with no incident, and was bending to slide the second board in place over the top of the well, when something circular and very hard pressed into the back of my head. I froze.
"That's right. Stay nice and still, and we'll have no problem. I'll tell you when to move."
It was very easy to imagine that light, sing-songy voice saying,
"What will you give me if I spin your straw into gold? I don't want to shoot you, kiddo, and I won't if I get what I came for."
And then he added, not as a laugh, but like words in a book, "Ha ha." Chapter 12. Christopher Pauly. Spilled gold. Not so nice. Preparations. 1. I can't remember how I felt at that moment. I can remember what I thought, though. Rumpelstiltskin is pointing a gun at the back of my head.
What's down there?
What?
You heard me. You were in that hole a long time. I was starting to think you died. So what's down there?
Now another thought came. He can't know. No one can. Pumping machinery. It was the first thing that came into my head.
Pumping machinery. Pumping machinery. That's what it is, haha.
Yes, otherwise everything floods in the backyard when it rains, and it runs down the street. Brains kicking into gear. It's old. I was checking to see if I've got to get someone from the city down here to look at it. You know, the water department.
Bullshit. Haha. What's really down there? Is there gold down there?
No, just machinery.
Don't turn around, kiddo. Wouldn't be smart. Not at all. You went down there with a great big gun, haha, to check on a water pump?
Rats, I said. My mouth was very dry. I thought there might be rats.
Bullshit story, total bullshit. What's that over there? More pumping machinery? Don't move, just look to your right.
I looked and saw the moldering corpse of the big cockroach Mr. Bowditch had shot. There wasn't much left. Even such feeble invention as I'd managed so far failed me, so I said I didn't know, and the man I was thinking of as Rumpelstiltskin didn't really care. He had his eyes on the prize.
Never mind. Right now, let's check out the old guy's safe. Maybe we'll check out the pumping machinery later. In the house, kiddo. And if you make any noise along the way, I'm going to blow your head off. But first I want you to unbuckle the shooting iron, partner, ha-ha, and drop it.
I started to bend over, meaning to undo the knots holding the tie-downs. The gun went back against my head and hard.
Did I tell you to bend over? I didn't. Just unbuckle the belt.
I unbuckled it. The holster hit my knee and turned over. The gun fell out on the shed floor.
Now you can buckle up again. Nice belt, haha.
At this point, I'm going to stop most of the ha-ha shit because he said it all the time as a kind of verbal punctuation. Just let me add that it was extremely Rumpelstiltskin-ish, which is to say creepy.
Now turn around.
I turned, and he turned with me. We were like figures in a music box.
Slow, chappie, slow.
I walked out of the shed. He walked with me. It had been overcast in the other world, but it was sunny here. I could see our shadows, his with one arm outstretched, and a shadow gun in his shadow hand. My brains had managed to get from low gear into second, but I was a long way from third. I'd been sandbagged, good and proper. We climbed the back porch steps. I unlocked the door, and we went into the kitchen. I remember thinking of all the times I'd been in here, never suspecting how soon I'd be entering for the last time, because he was going to kill me. Except he couldn't. I couldn't let him. I thought of people finding out about the Well of the Worlds and knew I couldn't let him. I thought about city cops or a state police SWAT team or army guys overrunning the shoe woman's little yard, tearing down her crisscrossing lines and leaving her shoes in the dirt, scaring her, and knew I couldn't let him. I thought of those guys tromping into the abandoned city and awakening whatever slept there, and knew I couldn't let him. Only, I couldn't stop him. The joke was on me. Ha ha. 2. Up the stairs to the second floor we went, me in the lead and Rumpel fucking Stiltskin behind me. I thought of suddenly lunging backward halfway up and knocking him the rest of the way down, but didn't try. It might work, but there was a good chance I'd be dead if it didn't. If Radar had been there, she'd have had a go at Rumple, old or not, and would likely be dead already.
Bedroom Chappie, the one with the safe.
I went into Mr. Bowditch's bedroom. You killed Mr. Heinrich, didn't you?
What? That's the stupidest thing I ever heard. They caught the bloke who did that.
I didn't pursue the subject. I knew, he knew, and he knew I knew. I knew other things as well. Number one was that if I claimed I didn't know the combination to the safe and persisted in that lie, he would kill me. Number two was a variation of number one.
Open the closet, kiddo.
I opened the closet. The empty holster flapped against my thigh. Some gunslinger I turned out to be.
Now open the safe.
If I do that, you'll kill me. There was a moment of silence as he digested this self-evident truth. Then he said,
No, I won't. I'll just tie you up.
Ha-ha. Ha-ha was exactly right, because how was he going to accomplish that? Mrs. Richland had said he was a little man, her height, which meant about 5'4". I was a foot taller, and had an athlete's build these days thanks to chores and bike riding. Tying me up without an accomplice to keep me covered would be impossible.
You will? Really?
I made my voice tremble, which was, believe me, not a problem.
Yes, now open the safe.
You promise?
Righto, old Beano. Now open it, or I'll put a bullet in the back of your knee and you'll never dance the tango again, ha-ha.
Okay, just as long as you really, totally promise not to kill me.
Already asked and answered, as they say in court. Open the safe!
Along with everything else I had to live for, I couldn't let that lilting voice be the last thing I heard. I just couldn't. Okay. I knelt in front of the safe. I thought, he's going to kill me. And, I can't let him kill me. And, I won't let him kill me. Because of Radar. Because of the shoe woman. And because of Mr. Bowditch, who had given me a burden to carry because there was simply no one else. I grew calm. There's quite a bit of gold, I said. I don't know where he got it, but it's awesome sauce. He paid his bills with it for years.
Stop talking and open the safe.
Then, as if he couldn't help himself.
How much?
Man, I don't know. Maybe $1 million worth? It's in a bucket that's so heavy I can't even lift it. I had no clue how to turn the tables on the little fucker. If we had been face to face, maybe. Not with the muzzle of a gun less than an inch from the back of my head. But once I got to the varsity level in the sports I played, I'd learned to shut off my brains at game time and let my body take over. I had to do that now. There was no other option. Sometimes in football games when we were behind, especially at away games where hundreds of people were jeering at us, I'd focus on the opposing quarterback and tell myself he was a nasty son of a bitch and I was going to not just sack him, but fucking flatten him. It didn't work very well unless the guy was a showboat who showed you his gloat face after a big play, but it worked on this guy. He had a gloat voice, and I had no problem hating him.
Quit stalling, old bean, old bean, old beanbag. Open the safe, or you'll never walk straight again.
Never walk at all was more like it. I turned the combination dial one way, then the other, then back the first way again. Three numbers down, one to go. I risked a look over my shoulder and saw a narrow face, a weasel's face, almost, under a retro White Sox ball cap with a high crown and a red circle where the O in socks belonged. Can I have at least some? He gave a tittery little laugh. Nasty.
Open it! Stop looking at me and open it!
I turned the combination to the last number. I pulled the handle. I couldn't see him looking over my shoulder, but I could smell him. Sour sweat, the kind that almost bakes into a person's skin after a long time without bathing. The safe swung open. I didn't hesitate because he who hesitates is lost. I grabbed the bucket by the rim and overturned it between my spread knees. Gold pellets flooded out and ran across the floor in all directions. At the same moment, I dived into the closet. He fired, the sound not much louder than a medium-sized firecracker. I felt the bullet go between my shoulder and my ear. The hem of one of Mr. Bowditch's old-fashioned suit coats twitched as the bullet passed through it. Mr. Bowditch had plenty of shoes. Dora would have been envious. I grabbed a brogan, rolled over on my side, and threw it. He ducked. I threw the other one. He ducked again, but it hit him in the chest. He backed up onto the gold pellets, which were still rolling, and his feet went out from under him. He landed hard with his legs splayed, but held on to his gun. It was a lot smaller than Mr. Bowditch's .45 revolver, which probably accounted for the low decibel bark. I didn't try to get to my feet, just squatted and uncoiled from the thighs on down. I flew over the rolling gold like Superman and landed on top of him. I was big, he was small. The air went out of him with a woof sound. His eyes were bulging. His lips were red and gleaming with spittle.
"Get off me!"
A labored, out-of-breath whisper. As if. I grabbed for the hand holding the gun, missed my grip, and grabbed again before he could bring it around to my face. The gun went off a second time. I don't know where that bullet went and didn't care because it didn't go into me. His wrist was slippery with sweat, so I clamped down with all my strength and twisted. There was a snap. He uttered a high-pitched scream. The gun fell from his hand and hit the floor. I picked it up and pointed it at him. He made that high-pitched scream again and put his good hand in front of his face, as if that would stop a bullet. The other one just flopped on his broken wrist, which was already beginning to swell.
"No, don't, please, don't shoot me, please."
Not one single fucking ha-ha. 3. You may have gotten a pretty good feeling about young Charlie Reed by this point, I'd guess. Sort of like a hero in one of those YA adventure novels. I'm the kid who stuck with his father when he was drinking, cleaned up his vomit, prayed for his recovery, on his knees, and actually got what he prayed for. I'm the kid who saved an old man when he fell off a ladder trying to clean the gutters. The kid who went to visit him in the hospital and then took care of him when he came home. Who fell in love with the old guy's faithful dog, and the faithful dog fell in love with him. I strapped on a .45 and braved a dark corridor, not to mention the giant wildlife therein, and came out in another world where I made friends with an old lady with a damaged face who collected shoes. I'm the kid who overpowered Mr. Heinrich's killer by cleverly dumping gold pellets all over the floor so he'd lose his balance and fall down. Gosh, I even played 2 varsity sports. Strong and tall, no acne. Perfect, right? Only I was also the kid who put firecrackers in mailboxes, blowing up what might have been somebody's important mail. I was the kid who smeared dog shit on the windshield of Mr. Dowdy's car and squeezed Elmer's glue in the ignition slot of Mrs. Kendrick's old Ford wagon when Bertie and I found it unlocked. I pushed over gravestones. I shoplifted. Bertie Bird was with me on all those expeditions, and it was the Birdman who phoned in the bomb threat, but I didn't stop him. There were other things that I'm not going to tell you about because I'm too ashamed. All I'll say is that we scared some little kids so bad they cried and pissed themselves. Not so nice, right? And I was mad at this little man in his dirty corduroy pants and his Nike warm-up jacket, and his clotted, greasy hair falling over the brow of his narrow weasel's face. I was mad, of course, because he would have killed me once he had the gold. He'd already killed once, so why not? I was mad because if he had killed me, the cops, possibly led by Detective Gleason and his intrepid sidekicks, Officers Whitmark and Cooper, would have entered the shed in the course of their investigations and found something that would have made the murder of Charles McGee Reed look piddling in comparison. I was maddest of all, you may not believe this, but I swear it's true, because the little man's intrusion made everything more difficult. Was I supposed to report him to the police? That would lead to the gold being discovered, and that would lead to about 10 zillion questions. Even if I picked it all up and put it back in the safe, Mr. Ha-Ha would tell them, maybe to get some consideration from the district attorney, maybe just out of spite. The solution to my problem was obvious. If he was dead, he couldn't tell anyone anything. Assuming Mrs. Richland's ears weren't as sharp as her eyes, and the two gunshots really hadn't been very loud, the police wouldn't have to come. I even had a place to hide the body, didn't I? 4. Although his hand was still in front of his face, I could see his eyes between his splayed fingers, blue threaded with red and starting to spill tears. He knew what I was thinking of doing. He could see it on my face.
No, please let me go, or call the police if you have to. Just don't kill me.
Like you were going to kill me?
I wasn't. I swear to God, I swear on my mother's grave, I swear I wasn't.
What's your name?
Derek. Derek Shepherd.
I hit him across the face with his gun. I could tell you I didn't mean to do it, or I didn't know I was going to do it until it was done, but those would be lies. I knew all right, and it felt good. Blood burst from his nose. More trickled down from the side of his mouth. You think I've never seen Grey's Anatomy, asshole? What's your name?
Justin Townes.
I hit him again. He tried to pull back, which did him no good. I'm not particularly fast on my feet, but there's nothing wrong with my reflexes. I'm pretty sure that one broke his nose instead of just bloodying it. He screamed, but in a high whisper. You must think I don't know Justin Townes Earl, either. I've even got one of his albums. You have one more chance, fuckwad, then I put a bullet in your head.
Polly,
he said. His nose was swelling, the whole side of his face was swelling, and he sounded like he had a bad cold.
Chris Polly.
Throw me your wallet.
I don't have...
He saw me draw back and put out the good hand again. I had plans for that hand, which will probably take me down even further in your estimation, but you have to remember I was in a fix. Also, I was thinking again of Rumpelstiltskin. Maybe I couldn't make this motherfucker stick his foot in the ground and tear himself in two, but I might be able to make him run away, like the gingerbread man. Ha ha.
Okay, okay.
He got up and reached into the back pocket of his cords, which weren't just dirty, they were filthy. The warm-up jacket had a torn sleeve and ragged cuffs. Wherever this guy was staying, it wasn't the Hilton. The wallet was beat up and scuffed. I flipped it open long enough to see a single 10 in the billfold and a driver's license with the name Christopher Pauly. It showed a picture of him as a younger man with an intact face. I flipped it closed and put it in my back pocket with my own wallet. Looks like your license expired in 2008. You might want to renew it, if you live long enough, that is.
I can't.
His mouth snapped closed. Can't renew it? Had it jerked? OUI or prison? Have you been to prison? Is that why it took you so long to rob and kill Mr. Heinrich? Because you were in Stateville?
Not there.
Where? He kept silent, and I decided I didn't care. As Mr. Bowditch might have said, it wasn't germane. How did you know about the gold?
I saw some in the Krauts store before I did my bit in county.
I could have asked how he found out who the gold came from and how he set up the vagrant, Dwyer, but I was pretty sure I knew both of those things.
Let me go. I'll never bother you again.
No, you won't, because you'll be in jail, and not just county jail. I'm calling the cops on you, Polly. You're going away for murder. So, let's hear you say ha-ha about that.
I'll tell. I'll tell about the gold. You won't get any.
Well, I would, actually. According to the will, it was mine, but he didn't know that. That's true, I said. Thanks for pointing it out. I'll have to put you with the pumping machinery after all. Lucky for me you're a little shit. I won't strain my back. I raised the gun. I could tell you it was a bluff, but I'm not sure it was. I also hated him for tearing up Mr. Bowditch's house, for defiling it. And, as I believe I've said, killing him would simplify everything. He didn't scream. I don't think he had air enough, but he moaned. The crotch of his pants darkened. I lowered the gun. A little. Suppose I told you you could live, Mr. Pauly. Not only live, but go your own way, like the song says. Would that interest you?
Yes. Yes. Let me go, and I'll never bother you again.
Spoken like a true Rumpelstiltskin, I thought. How did you get here? Did you walk? Take the bus as far as Dearborn Avenue? Given the single 10 in his billfold, I doubted if he'd taken a Uber. He could have cleaned out Mr. Heinrich's back room. The stuff planted on Dwyer made that seem likely. But if so, he hadn't converted any of his stash into cash. Maybe he didn't know how. He might be crafty, but that wasn't necessarily the same thing as being smart or connected.
I came through the woods.
He gestured with his good hand in the direction of the greenbelt behind Mr. Bowditch's property, all that remained of the century woods that had covered this part of town a century ago. I reappraised his filthy pants and torn jacket. Mrs. Richland hadn't said the little man's corduroys were dirty, and she would have. Her eyes were sharp. But she had seen him days ago. My guess was that he hadn't just come through the woods, he was living in them. Somewhere, not far from the fence at the rear of Mr. Bowditch's yard, there was probably a piece of scavenged tarp serving as a shelter, with this man's few possessions inside. Any swag from Mr. Heinrich's store would be buried close by the way storybook pirates did it. Only storybook pirates buried their doubloons and pieces of eight in chests. Polly's was more likely in a satchel with a sticker on it saying Subscription Service of America. If I was right, his camp would have been close enough to keep an eye out for one Charles Reed. He'd know who I was from Heinrich. He could have seen me on my trip to Stantonville. And, after Polly's search of the house netted nothing but an unopenable safe, he had just waited for me, assuming I would come for the gold, because it's what he would do. Get up. We're going downstairs. Watch out for the gold BBs unless you want to take another spill.
Can I have a few? Just a few. I'm broke, man.
And do what? Use one to pay for lunch at McDonald's?
I know a man in Shy. He won't give me what they're worth, but...
You can have three.
Five?
Trying to smile like he hadn't been planning to kill me once the safe was open. Four. He bent and picked them up quickly with his good hand, and went to stuff them in his pants pocket. That's five. Drop one. He gave me a narrow, angry look, a Rumpelstiltskin look, and dropped one. It rolled.
You're a mean kid.
Coming from St. Christopher of the Woods, that fills me with shame. He lifted his lip, showing yellowing teeth.
Fuck you.
I raised his gun, which I thought was a 22 automatic. You should never say fuck you to someone with a firearm. Not wise, ha-ha. Now go downstairs. He left the room, cradling his broken wrist to his chest and squeezing the gold pellets in his good hand. I followed. We went through the living room and into the kitchen. He stopped at the door. Keep going. Across the backyard. He turned to look at me, eyes wide and mouth trembling.
You're going to kill me and put me down in that hole.
I wouldn't have given you any of the gold if I was going to do that, I said.
You'll take it back.
He was starting to cry again.
You'll take it back and put me down in the hole.
I shook my head. There's a fence and you've got a broken wrist. You won't get over it without help.
I'll manage. I don't want your help.
Walk, I said. He walked, crying, sure he was going to be shot in the back of the head. Because, again, it was what he would do. He only stopped blubbering when we passed the open door of the shed and he found himself still alive. We came to the fence, which was about 5 feet high, tall enough to keep radar in when she had been younger. I don't want to see you again.
You won't.
Not ever.
You won't, I promise.
Shake on it, then. I stuck out my hand. He took it. Crafty, but not all that smart, like I said. I twisted his hand and heard the crack of splintering bones. He shrieked and went to his knees with both hands held to his chest. I stuffed the .22 in the back of my pants like a bad guy in a movie, bent, grabbed him, and lifted. It was easy. He couldn't have weighed more than 140, and at that point I was so jacked on adrenaline it was practically shooting out my ears. I threw him over the fence. He landed on his back in a pile of dead leaves and broken branches, gasping little cries of pain. His hands flopped uselessly. I leaned over the fence like a washerwoman in a story, eager for the latest village gossip. "Go, Polly. Run away and never come back."
"You broke my hands. You broke my fucking—"
"You're lucky I didn't kill you," I shouted at him. "I wanted to, almost did, and if I ever see you again, I will. Now go, while you still have the chance." He gave me one more look. Blue eyes, wide, swelling face smeared with snot and tears. Then he turned and blundered into the poor-ass second growth that was all that remained of the Century Woods, broken hands held to his chest. I watched him go without the slightest regret for what I'd done. Not very nice. Would he come back? Not with two broken wrists, he wouldn't. Would he tell someone else, a friend or a partner in crime? I didn't think Polly had any partners or friends. Would he go to the cops? Given what I knew about Heinrich, the idea was ludicrous. All that aside, I simply couldn't bring myself to kill him in cold blood. I went back inside and picked up the gold pellets. They were everywhere, and it took longer than the whole confrontation with Polly. I put them in the safe along with the empty concho belt and holster, then left. I made sure to untuck my shirt so it hung over the gun stuffed into my pants at the small of my back. But I was still glad Mrs. Richland wasn't out at the end of the driveway, with her hand shielding her sharp eyes. 5. I walked back down the hill slowly, because my legs were trembling. Hell, my mind was trembling. I was climbing my own front porch steps before realizing that I was also hungry. Ravenous, in fact. Radar was waiting to greet me, but not in the frantic way I expected, just a happy wag, a few bounces, and a head rub against my thigh before heading back to her rug. I realized I'd expected frantic because it felt like I'd been gone a long time. In reality, it had been less than 3 hours. A lot had happened in those hours. Life-changing stuff. I thought of Scrooge in A Christmas Carol saying, "The spirits have done it all in one night." There was leftover meatloaf in the fridge, and I made a couple of thick sandwiches, going heavy on the ketchup. I needed to fuel up, because my day was only beginning. I had a lot to do to prepare for tomorrow. I would not be going back to school, and my dad might, probably would, be coming home to an empty house. I was going to try to find the sundial Mr. Bowditch had spoken of. I no longer doubted it was there, and I no longer doubted it could turn back time for the elderly German shepherd currently snoozing on her rug in the living room. I was less sure that I could get her down those winding steps, and I had no idea how I was supposed to get her 40 or 50 or 60 miles to the city. The one thing I was sure of, I couldn't afford to wait. 6. As I ate, I thought. If I was going to be gone, and with radar, I had to lay a false trail that would lead in some direction other than to Mr. Bowditch's house. An idea came to me while I was going out to the garage, and I thought it would serve. It would have to. I got my dad's wheelbarrow, and a bonus. On one of the shelves was a bag of calcium hydroxide, more commonly known as quicklime. And why did Dad have that? You guessed it. Roaches. Some in our basement, some in the garage. I put the bag in the wheelbarrow, then went into the house and showed Radar her leash. "If I take you to the top of the hill, will you be good?" She assured me with her eyes that she would, so I hooked her up and we walked to one sycamore, me pushing the wheelbarrow and she walking beside it. Mrs. Richland was back at her usual post, and I half expected her to ask what all the rumpus had been about earlier. She didn't, just asked if I was planning to do some more work around the place. I said I was.
You're very good to do it. I suppose his estate will be putting it up for sale, won't they? Maybe the estate will even pay you, but I wouldn't count on it. Lawyers are stingy. I hope the new owners don't tear it down. It looks so much nicer now. Do you know who inherited?
I said I didn't.
Well, if you happen to find out the asking price, let me know. We've been thinking about selling ourselves.
We suggested there was a Mr. Richland. Who knew? I said I would be sure to do that, in a pig's eye, and rolled the wheelbarrow around back with the end of Radar's leash looped over my wrist. The old girl was moving well, but it wasn't a particularly long walk up the hill. Miles to the abandoned city, though? She'd never make it. Radar was calmer this time, but as soon as I unhooked her leash, she went straight to the sofa bed in the living room, sniffed it over from end to end, and laid down beside it. I brought her a bowl of water, then went out to the shed with the bag of quicklime. I shook it over the remains of the cockroach and watched with some amazement as the decay sped up to a sprint. There was a hissing, bubbling sound. Vapor rose from the remains, which would soon be nothing but a puddle of lime slime. I picked up the revolver, took it back into the house, and put it in the safe. I saw a couple of pellets that had rolled away into a corner and dropped them into the bucket with the rest of the gold. When I went downstairs, Radar was fast asleep. Good, I thought. Get all the sleep you can, because tomorrow is going to be a busy day for you, girl. This was already a busy one for me, and that was also good. It didn't keep me from thinking about the other world, the red poppies flanking the path, the shoe woman with almost no face, the glassy towers of the city. But staying busy probably kept me from having a delayed reaction to my close call with Christopher Pauly, and it had been close. Very. The little bastard hadn't bothered with the stacks of reading matter in the hall between the kitchen and the back door in his hunt for the gold. I didn't bother with the books, but I spent an hour wheelbarrowing stacks of magazines, conveniently done up in hay rope, out to the shed. I stacked some over the remains of the roach. I piled most of them near the Well of the Worlds. When I went down the next time, when we went down, I'd put the stacks on the boards and try to cover the opening entirely. When I was done, I went back to the house and woke Radar. I gave her a treat from the pantry and walked her back home. I reminded myself to bring along her toy monkey tomorrow. She might want it once we got to where we were going. If, that was, she didn't fall off those stairs and pull me with her. If she'd go down the stairs at all. When I got back, I put Polly's .22 auto, his wallet, and some other stuff into my pack. Not much, I'd add more tomorrow from Mr. Bowditch's pantry, and then sat down to write my father. I wanted to put it off, and knew I couldn't afford to. That was a hard letter to write. Dear Dad, you're going to come back to an empty house because I have gone to Chicago with Radar. I found someone on the internet who has had amazing success with renewing the health and vitality of aging dogs. I've known about this guy for some time, but didn't want to tell you because I know how you feel about quack cures. Maybe that's what this is, but I can easily afford $750 thanks to my inheritance. I won't tell you not to worry because I know you will, even though there's nothing to worry about. What I will tell you is please don't try to fix your worry with a drink. If I came back and found you were boozing again, it would break my heart. Don't try to call me because I'm turning off my phone. On or off wouldn't matter where I was going. I will be back, and if this works, I'll be back with a brand new dog. Trust me, Dad. I know what I'm doing. Love, Charlie. Well, I hoped I knew. I put the note in an envelope, wrote Dad on the front, and left it on the kitchen table. Then I opened my laptop and wrote an email to dsilvius@hillviewhigh.edu. It covered much the same territory. I thought if Mrs. S. had been in the room while I was typing, she would have smelled hooky all over me. I set the email to arrive on her office computer Thursday afternoon. 2 days of unexplained absence I could get away with, but probably not three. My purpose was to give Dad as much time at his retreat as I could. I could hope Mrs. S. wouldn't call him when she got my email, but I knew she probably would, and he might be headed back then anyway. The real purpose was to tell as many people as possible that I was going to Chicago. To that end, I called the cop shop and asked if Detective Gleason was there. He was, and I asked him if they had any leads in the home invasion at 1 Sycamore Street. I wanted to ask today because I'm taking Mr. Bowditch's dog to Chicago tomorrow. I've found someone there who's done wonders with older dogs. Gleason told me there was nothing new, which was what I expected. I had taken care of the home invader myself, or so I hoped. Gleason wished me good luck with the old pooch. That was a wish I took to heart. 7. That evening, I tucked 3 more of the new pills into Radar's chow. I would give her 3 more tomorrow. There weren't many more left in the bottle, but maybe that was okay. I didn't know for sure what they were, but I had an idea they were doggy speed. They were shortening her life at the same time they were pepping her up. I told myself I just had to get her down the steps, and after that, well, I didn't know after that. My phone was working again, although I'd had to do a hard reset to get it to show the right time, and around 7 o'clock, it rang. Dad was in the window. I turned on the TV and jacked the volume a little before answering it. Hey, Charlie, everything okay?
It's fine. Climb any trees?
He laughed.
No trees. It's raining up here. A lot of rah-rah team spirit instead. Insurance guy's gone wild. What are you watching?
Sports Center.
Dog okay?
Raids?
She looked up from her rug.
She's good.
Still eating?
Every bite of her dinner and licked the bowl.
Glad to hear it.
We talked a little more. He seemed unworried, so I guess I was putting on a good front. That made me glad and ashamed at the same time.
I'll give you a call tomorrow night if you want.
Nah, I might go out for burgers and mini golf with a bunch of guys.
And girls?
Well, there might be girls present. I'll call you if something happens, like the house catches on fire.
Sounds like a plan.
Sleep well, Chip. You too. From where I was sitting, I could see the letter on the kitchen table. I didn't like lying to my dad, but didn't see any other choice. It was an extraordinary situation. I killed the TV and got ready to turn in at 8 o'clock for the first time since forever, but I was planning on rising early. Soonest begun, soonest done, my mother used to say. Sometimes I couldn't exactly remember what she looked like without checking her picture, but I could remember all her little sayings. The mind is a weird machine. I locked up, but not because I was afraid of Polly. He probably knew where I lived, but he had 2 broken hands and I had his gun. He was also without money and ID. My guess was that he was already hitching to what he called shy, where he'd try to turn those 4 gold pellets into cash. If he was able to sell them at all, I thought he'd get no more than 20 cents on the dollar, and that was all right with me. Awesome sauce. Every time I started to feel sorry for him or guilty about what I'd done, I thought of him pressing the barrel of his little gun against the back of my head and telling me not to turn around. It wouldn't be smart. I was glad I didn't kill him, though. There was that. I examined myself closely in the mirror as I brushed my teeth. I thought I looked the same as ever, which was sort of amazing after everything that had happened. I rinsed out my mouth, turned, and saw Radar sitting in the bathroom doorway. I bent and ruffled the fur at the sides of her face.
You want to go on an adventure tomorrow, girl?
She thumped her tail, then went into the guest room and lay down at the foot of my bed. I double-checked my alarm to make sure it was set for 5 a.m., then turned off the light. I expected it would take me a long time to go to sleep after the day's roller coaster ride, but I started to drift almost at once. I asked myself if I was really going to risk my life and certainly get into a shitload of trouble, both with my dad and at school, for an old dog who had already had, in canine years, a hell of a good run. The answer seemed to be yes, but that wasn't all. It was the wonder of the thing, the mystery of it. I had found another world, for Christ's sake. I wanted to see the city with the green towers and find out if it really was Oz, only with a terrible monster, Gogmagog, at its heart, instead of a humbug projecting his voice from behind a curtain. I wanted to find the sundial and see if it actually did what Mr. Bowditch said it did. And you have to remember, I was 17, a prime age for both adventuring and foolish decisions. But, yeah, it was mostly about the dog. I loved her, you see, and I didn't want to let her go. I rolled over on my side and went to sleep. Chapter 13. Calling Andy. Radar decides. Stew. Googer. 1. Raid seemed surprised that we were getting up in the dark, but she was willing to eat her breakfast, 3 more pills buried in it, and walk up the hill to number 1. The Richland house was dark. I went upstairs to the safe, strapped on the .45, and tied it down. With Polly's .22 auto in my backpack, that made me a regular two-gun Sam. There were some empty spaghetti sauce jars in the pantry. I filled 2 with dry Origin dog food, screwed the lids on tight, wrapped them in a dish towel, and put them in my pack beneath a t-shirt and a pair of underwear. Never leave on a trip without clean undershorts, was another of my mom's sayings. To this I added a dozen cans of King Oscar sardines, for which I'd gotten a taste, a sleeve of crackers, a few pecan sandies, only a few because I'd been nibbling on them, and a handful of perky jerky sticks. Also the 2 remaining Cokes from the fridge. I also tossed my wallet in my pack so I could put the long-barreled flashlight into my back pocket, as before. You could say these were extremely thin supplies for what might be a round trip of as much as 100 miles, and, of course, you'd be right, but my backpack was only so big, and besides, the shoe woman had offered to stand me a meal. Perhaps she could even add to my supplies. Otherwise, I'd just have to forage, an idea that filled me with both anxiety and excitement. The thing that troubled me the most was the padlock on the shed door. I thought if the shed was locked, nobody would bother about it. If it wasn't, somebody might check it out, and concealing the top of the well with piles of old magazines was mighty thin camouflage. I'd gone to sleep with this Agatha Christie-type problem unsolved, but had woken up with what seemed to me to be a good answer. Not only would the shed be locked from the outside, there would be someone else to say I'd taken radar to Chicago in hopes of a miracle cure. Andy Chen was the solution. I waited until 7 o'clock to call him, thinking that by then he'd be up and getting ready for school. But after 4 rings, I was pretty sure my call was going to voicemail. I was thinking out the message I'd leave when he answered, sounding impatient and a little out of breath.
What do you want, Reed? I just got out of the fucking shower and I'm dripping all over the floor.
Ooh,
I said in a high falsetto.
Is the Yellow Peril naked?
Very funny, you racist fuck. What do you want?
Something important.
What's up?
Sounding serious now.
Look, I'm at the highball outside town. You know, the highball, right?
Of course he did. It was a truck stop with the best assortment of video games in Century. We'd cram into some licensed driver's car, or take the bus if no one with a license happened to be handy, and play until the money ran out, or until we got kicked out.
What are you doing there? It's a school day.
I've got the dog, the one that scared you so bad when we were kids. She's not doing so well, and there's someone in Chicago who's supposed to be able to help old dogs, kind of rejuvenate them.
It's a scam, Andy said flatly. Gotta be. Don't be stupid, Charles. When dogs get old, they get old. End of story. Will you shut up and listen? This guy's giving me and Raids a ride in his van for $30.
$30?
I have to go right now, or he's gonna leave without us. I need you to lock up the house. You forgot to lock your own...
No, Mr. Bowditch's. I forgot.
How did you get out to the high bar?
I'm going to lose my ride if you don't shut up. Lock the house, will you? I left the keys on the kitchen table.
Then, as if it were an afterthought.
And lock the shed out back, too? The padlock's hanging on the door. I'll have to ride my bike to school instead of taking the bus. How much will you pay me?
Andy, come on.
I'm kidding, Reed. I won't even ask you to blow me. But if anyone asks, they won't.
If they do, tell them the truth. I went to Chicago. I don't want you to get in trouble. Just lock up the house for me and the shed. I'll get the keys from you when we get back.
Yeah, I can do that. Are you staying overnight or
probably, maybe even two nights? I gotta go. Thanks, Andy. I owe you one.
I ended the call, shouldered my backpack, and grabbed the leash.
I dropped Mr. Bowditch's key ring on the table and hooked radar up. At the foot of the back steps, I stopped, looking across the grass to the shed. Did I really mean to get her down those narrow, winding steps of varying heights on a leash? Bad idea for both of us. It wasn't too late to call it off. I could hit Andy back and tell him either I'd changed my mind at the last minute or the fictional van driver had left without me. I could walk Radar home, tear up the letter on the kitchen table, and trash the email that was waiting to go out to Mrs. Silvius. And he was right. When dogs got old, they got old. End of story. That didn't mean I couldn't still explore the other place. I'd just have to wait. Until she died. I unhooked her leash and started walking toward the shed. Halfway there, I looked back. She was still sitting where I'd left her. I thought about calling her. The urge was strong, but I didn't. I kept walking. At the door to the shed, I looked back again. She was still sitting at the foot of the back steps. I felt the sourness of disappointment that all my preparation, especially my inspiration about the padlock, had gone to waste. But there was no way I was going to leave her sitting there. I was about to start back when Radar got to her feet and walked hesitantly across the backyard.